Welcome to the Designing Hollywood podcast in association with the John Campia Show. I am your host, Robert Meyer Burnett. And this episode is sponsored by Paris Costumes. Today we have a returning guest on the show who is a multi-award winning costume designer, a producer, and an entrepreneur. Her work spans from Katy Perry's Super Bowl performance to The Masked Singer on Fox to a new live interpretation of the Disney classic Beauty and the Beast. Always pushing the boundaries and opening doors for young women and men in entertainment, she has put her creative mark on television's biggest shows, tours, live entertainment, and so much more. This six-time Emmy Award winner is recognized globally for her intricate and imaginative designs. Please welcome back to the Designing Hollywood podcast and in the studio for the first time, Marina Toybina. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. That sounded fancy.
Did it sound fancy? Yeah. Fancy?
No. Fancy, well, introduction.
You're very fancy in yourself. So I have to ask you, I didn't get to meet you the first time you came on the show, but you do a lot of live events.
I do.
Which is, I talk to a lot of people on the show about costume design for not live events, film and that kind of thing. Right. But live events are different because you're interacting on a stage. It's more akin to theater, but there's studio audiences and you've got costume changes and for concert tours and things. And I'm just curious, could you tell us sort of the philosophical difference between a live costume display and something, say, for film or TV that isn't live performance based?
I think for starters, it's like the stress level. I think the pressure of it. Yeah. I often find myself like trying to like time out my life. You know, it's not something that I get like the luxury of 6 months to prep or, you know, I know concepts ahead of time. It really is one of those things where I feel like I end up designing instinctually rather than really having that time to do the research or the proper footwork to get myself ready. It's one of those things like, I know my team, I know what we're capable of, I'm diving into the project, and then the world opens up for me. You know,
it's right.
Majority of the contemporary dance shows I've done, it's almost like you either know your skill or you don't, you know, and through each episode, I learn more and more. And of course, like your talent and your creativity and your knowledge develops. But at the same time, if I get a creative, you know, Monday evening and we film live Thursday or Friday, what do you do in 3 days? You know, you're against time. You're on a 12-hour day, in my case, 18 to 20-hour days. And I think you just somehow prepare yourself to work faster than time. I don't know how else to describe it.
Sure.
It's almost like 24 hours doesn't really exist for me because I have to like think ahead every minute and at the same time understand how to still tell my stories. You know, it's not just putting a costume on stage and hoping that people will like it. It still has to have a meaning and a definition and an interpretation and a feeling, and all that stuff comes with the limited space that you're in. So I think that probably is the biggest difference, where I'm like a ticking time bomb when it comes to, you know, getting things done on time.
Well, I was curious, like for The Masked Singer, did you have carte blanche to create whatever designs, like how did you come up? I mean, I loved those designs for The Masked Singer. Were those a combination of you and the performer? Was that the producers telling you they wanted a certain kind of thing? How did you begin creating something like a Masked Singer persona and costume, the whole thing? How do you do that?
When I was first approached about the show, I was very intrigued, but at the same time, I needed to know more. So when I knew the concept already existed in Korea and, you know, I got to see all the footage and I started kind of understanding what the show was about. And when I went in for my interview with the EPs and I was like, I get this and it's beautiful and it's nice, but what if we took it a step forward? What if instead of just putting our talent in a mask, give me a chance to create narratives? You know, what if the experience that I've had through my entire career, I was able to kind of put together and bring the right team together, and we just tried something new. So with season one, that was kind of experimental for us. So I kind of took those characters a step forward rather than just, you know, creating a mask. That was kind of like my first major attempt. And how do I make these magical creatures live and breathe on stage at the same time? I don't suffocate my talent. And somehow it worked for us. I think there was some sort of a hit factor about that show where you weren't just looking at a pretty walkabout costume. And that was like a big thing for me, is I didn't want to take the mascot route. I really wanted to experiment with fashion and bring my background into it. That's what I studied, that's what I majored in. And for the longest time, I thought maybe the intricacy is what was missing in live television, you know, that it's that paying attention to detail and telling stories. Like, you see all these shows, they're like almost fast turnarounds. But at the same time, I still wanted to give some sort of like food for thought, you know, that
Right.
it wasn't just a theory that live television is so different from film. There was a place for it, for me to try to bring these characters to life, that it looked like a movie, you know, and kind of that balance between cinema and theater, but at the same time bring it to a reality platform, you know. And I think it worked for us, and I got the freedom to kind of start pitching my own ideas. And I would do all the prep like about 4 or 5 weeks prior to us even discussing cast or what the next season is going to be like. So I would present all my renderings and discuss what my characters were about. We would then kind of select our favorites, see what the seasons were missing previously, where can we push the boundary. And a lot of it was like, I listened to the fans. I got so much fan mail from kids, you know. I think I didn't expect that it would hit like that deep within, like, people were fans of their own characters. It was almost like creating some sort of like mass singing superheroes,
Right,
you
yeah.
know. And everyone had their own and were rooting for their own. It like kind of became this dynamic between a game of unmasking and then really like kind of falling in love with the characters that we were seeing on stage.
Did you like so you would create a pantheon of characters at the beginning of the season and then kind of tailor them as you went through? Like how what happened when you would then get, did you know who was going to be the Masked Singer beforehand?
No, absolutely not. Every time we end a season, I would again come up with a compilation of designs, bring it forward to Fox and the EPs. We would discuss like what we loved, what possibly could have been like the second option.
Right.
And then as casting was coming in, we would do like our introduction welcome calls. I would get, you know, on a call with our talent, explain to them a few options. Or there's
Oh,
many
so.
times, yeah, many times it was like the one I thought was the best fit, that was like the winning ticket. But there were some moments where they're like, hey, I have my ideas as well, which would then take me back to the drawing board, and it became more of a collaboration. So there were scenarios where I catered to who we had on the show
Yeah,
and
that's
tried
what
to
I was
fill
going to
out.
ask, because if you've got singers that want. Now, was that frustrating for you as a creative? You'd already sort of done the homework, but then someone comes in and goes, no, nah, this is what I was thinking.
No,
Or.
not at all. I feel like it. My goal was to always create a beautiful show, you know, and I feel like there's moments that work for stage where you do take somebody out of their comfort zone,
Right.
and there's moments that don't. And I think just like knowing for me who I was dealing with, and there were so many people that I was huge fans of that were on the show, and almost a dream for me to work with, the why not take it a step forward and open that conversation to,
Yeah.
okay, if you love this the way it is, great. And then the next person comes around, they're like, this is what I've always wanted to be. Or a lot of people did it for their grandkids or their kids. So taking that in consideration, I was like, okay, this is something that's meaningful, you know. And even throughout my 6 season run, there's many moments that I would ask our talent, is there something special I need to incorporate? Is there like a hidden message, you know, within a costume that only like your family or friends would know? So there was a lot of like specialty details and like my way of contributing to who was on the show.
Now, doing something like that, obviously fabrics and looks are important. What were there fabrics you had to stay away from because they're heavy? Like you couldn't give somebody wool or like a gabardine. It has to breathe in it. So, did you have fabrics of choice?
You know, every character was so different because you're starting with a sketch. Of course, like the world is your oyster, where you feel like you can do everything, but then we're going back to the drawing board of limited time frames, you know.
Right.
So for me, I try to come as close to my design as possible. And by knowing finally who was going in the costume, I was very conscious of body types, age, health conditions. Like, I had a whole questionnaire that I had,
Oh.
even on my welcome call, to being like, are you claustrophobic? What I should or shouldn't use? What kind of footwear can we use? If this is the weight of the mask, if these are my dimensions, then I need a back brace. You know, there's a lot that went into it with my own team. as to how we can accommodate everyone's kind of needs and requirements. And at the same time, for me not to give away too much of my art or push back on it. And we did a lot of that during fittings as well, where, you know, certain things that didn't work, even though my team and I would try everything prior to our first initial fitting, there were moments when somebody would be like, hey, I still can't breathe or I still can't see. Right. So we would go back, recut, you know, whatever we needed to do. But I knew how to manipulate all those things creatively by using, like, my strength as detail, you know? So it's like, I'm keen on proper trims, notions, like making sure like my pattern making is on point, that I'm really like hugging the body first and then building on it. So the person felt like they're in a costume, but at the same sense, my dimensions and my world was around them. You know, even our weight distribution, like we made sure that if something was of height, there was a structure build that could support the upper and lower back. So it almost like everything became like a science or experimental experience. But I was very, very aware of that first, you know, that it's like durability, being able to function, being able to breathe, using ice packs, cooling vests, whatever we had to do to really like get the artistic point across. And again, like I'm such an open communicator that it was easy for me to kind of walk in the room for those fittings. And I think it's also important, and you've probably seen this, a designer that's there from beginning to end will know how to execute. You know, it's like not just being present through the artwork and the explanations and the calls, but I was there every step of the way through pattern making to I have this thing. I have to buy my own fabrics. I source out my own textiles. It's very difficult for me to send out my team. Even if they swatch, I still would like look at everything and go back and do it myself. And I think that is one of the biggest attributes to my work, is when I can feel and I can touch, I kind of know in my gut that it will work. So right. Because of that, I feel like it helped me achieve some of those intricate and really difficult details through being able to be so hands-on, you know.
Now, did you always want to get in? I mean, I'm sure you probably did this in your first interview, going into more of your background and performance, but you started out even in music videos with Britney Spears, you know, and that was like your first credited. Did you always want to go into that live performance track? And I mean, did you grow up wanting... Was costume design in your blood from an early age? I mean, you went to fit them. You obviously had the academic background, but did you always want to get into rock and roll?
I think that was the true essence of who I am, was rock and roll. But I started very young. I started sketching 11, 13. I was already using my mom's nail polish to create glitter on my sketches and using like anything I could. I produced my first thing when I was 16 after graduating high school, went back and did the first prom fashion show that was done my way, my design.
Wow.
While I was attending FITM. I think truly my first love subconsciously was fashion. But then now that I look back, the theater in me was always there, because I grew up in Moscow. So my mom and I would go to Bolshoi Theater and I would see all the plays, and I was always at some sort of like dance conventions where we would stay up doing my own costumes. So I think somehow that lifestyle was always around me and within me. And then naturally, I've always had a love for music. That's something that heals my soul. It's something till this day. It helps me get through whatever's going on. And somehow I feel like my experience with fashion led me straight into music by doing dancers, starting there. At the same time, I was still doing my fashion stuff and pitching it to stylists and doing editorial work. I think somehow it's like a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of hard work, but a little bit of everything led me to like this road that, I don't know, destiny. I don't even know what to call it. It's like seems so natural that as much focus as I gave to fashion design and geared me towards costumes.
Sure.
And now I'm in the position where I can kind of take it all and soak it in and be able to bring so much fashion to my theatrical work at the same time. Do all this research to then create costuming on a different level. I don't even know what to do, but music was always my first passion. So
how did you get to that? You know, everyone's sort of got an interesting story. They were doing, because work always begets work, and people don't understand. You never know. you could be working on something and you never know, someone behind you is like, hey, I really like your work.
Right.
I've got a movie to start tomorrow. Right. Would you like to? So how did you make to go from FITM and leave school and get that professional, first professional gig?
Oh man, I worked so hard. Even while I was still in FITM, I was already sitting on Model Mayhem and what was it back then? Friendster and MySpace and trying to reach out to photographers, you know, and a lot of it was collaborating with people and just trying sewing out of my kitchen, my living room, just working with new individuals and new, and it kind of was that way where like one little collaboration led me to this stylist and then it became word of mouth. And then out of that came to stylists for editorials and not just photo shoots, you know, and a lot of it was a trade exchange, you know, it's like you're trying to build your portfolio. And I'm not sure if it's done the same way now, but back then it's almost like there was no other way but paying your dues, you know, and back then, 20 years ago, but, and for me, it was just like, I didn't give up. I had 3 side jobs. I worked at Buffalo Exchange, Crossroads. I mean, waitress, actually, this is a crazy story, but I was Bob Mackie's waitress for about 5 years.
Bob Mackie's, yes. You're not the first. Daniel Orlandi, who was, I've interviewed on this podcast, was his assistant for like 5 years. How did you get to be Bob Mackie's waitress? And did you know
I
him?
I used to waitress at Coyote Pizza Place at Tahunga Village. And I remember he would come in every once in a while for his humble salad. And I just knew who it was. And I never...
Did you ever let on?
No. I think I was so, it was such a weird hidden motivation for me that it's like, oh, someday, you know, I'll get to like meet him on a different level. And I, there was something, I don't know if it was pride inside of me back then, but there was a lot going on and I was pulling on my own fashion shows that I didn't want to be just that other person, be like, I'm an inspiring this and that, you know? I'm so happy that I didn't say anything because now I feel like 20
years later.
In all
that time, you never said anything?
If I see him, then I can be like, you were such an inspiration for me. You have no idea that I like waitress and saved every penny to like get me one step closer to my dream, you know? But but to answer your question, a lot of it was trial and error. You know, I remember the harder times. I didn't have a place to live. Couch surf. And still at the same time, tried everything I could not to let many people know what was going on and never kind of went on the dark side, but really tried to make it happen, you know. And I think for me, it was I started such a young age. I believed that this was the way to go. I just didn't know how to get there. And every day I was just trying and meeting new people. And I started meeting stylists that were more involved with stage. And that's how... I started meeting choreographers as well and working with dancers. And Brian Friedman, who's an iconic choreographer, was my first step into television. He called me. We did multiple projects together. And of course, it's like, you know, me proving my work and doing styling here and design here and doing everything out of my place. And he called me one day and he was like, X Factor is looking for a costume designer. And I'm like, great. So I went in for an interview, had no idea that unions existed or guilds, you know, it's like,
unions? What are those?
There's not even a book to tell you how to really like start this stuff.
Right.
And I had my interview with the executive and he was like, great. So, you know, let's contact your union, get you all the paperwork and see if you can do this. And I was like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And I had 72 hours to call the guild and somehow by miracle, I had the right production schedules and titles to pull it off. And I went in and I was like, listen, this is my shot. I know, you know, it probably takes way longer to process somebody through the guild, but whatever money I have, I will pay for my fees. And I got in and
that's a testament to you though, because you had the background. You know, I've known people that haven't had the background. They can't. That's great that you did that.
I mean, I remember it was the craziest, like, few days trying to get letters of recommendation from directors and trying to figure out, you know, do I have a costume design credit? Please, God, tell me I have a costume design credit somewhere. And somehow it worked. And I remember my first day, I just sat in the trailer. I didn't know what to do. Never worked on a union show. And my supervisor didn't show up that day, so it was just me. I didn't even know you're supposed to have a wardrobe supervisor, you know, and I was just like, what do I do? So I called that night, and she was like, did you get the fabrics? Did you start writing a shopping list? And I'm like, I just know how to design, you know, I just know how to put it all together. So that was like a crazy experience in my life. And from there, it was just like, okay, I got to learn fast, you know, and I have to like adapt. And my team grew from there. And that was about 15 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. I got to ask you a question. Cause maybe only I, you worked on a Star Trek fan film project.
I did.
Now I know those guys.
Yes.
And Star Trek New Voyages, James Colley and that whole bunch. How did you come to work on that?
My pizza place. One of the directors was always coming in, and
that's amazing.
That was there was a few people that knew that I was going to school for fashion, or you know, I'm trying to break in. And one day we just started talking about costumes and what I do, and he was like, "I have one character. If you want to give it a shot, there's no budget, no money, but if you want to like try to see what you can do and bring it on set." And I did. I spent nights working on this, you know, and I brought the costume to set and they loved it and I got used. And
wow. Yeah. It's, and I'm talking to you about it 20 years later, practically. Yeah. That's amazing.
I forgot that happened, but it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I looked, I did my research.
Yes.
So, well, that's fantastic. I mean, I try to explain to a lot of people that in the business, everyone thinks that the store is going to open and everyone's going to walk through it. And then suddenly you're going to be, it's never like that.
Oh, it's still not like that.
No, it's, and it's what you did is sometimes the same thing it happened to me. You're sitting in the trailer wondering, what do I do now?
Right.
And you just have to go with it. You can't ever.
Every project I do, every single thing, no matter like how much experience I have, I get nervous. I get scared. Even with one of the biggest projects I just finished, where do you start? How do you do
right.
this? How do you, you know, learn how to communicate with new directors, with new producers, whether there's people on the team that you know, this is a, you know, new expectation. And every time I get nervous, I get cold feet. I don't know if I can do this. I don't know how to do this. And every time I'm done, I still don't know how it happened. Every single time I finish a project, if you ask me to redo it, I could not do it. If you asked me to duplicate my own work, I could not do it.
Well, now you just finished working with My Chemical Romance,
yes.
which is a band that I dig. Gerard Way is also a comic book writer and artist, created the Umbrella Academy.
Yep.
So, first of all, how did you get that job? Because there's a design. I mean, the look of that band and what they like to do and what they're influenced by, that they're not just your typical rock band. So what was it like? How did you get that job? And you designed the whole tour, right?
I collaborated with the lead singer, yes, with Gerard. Okay, good. Everything kind of has its place in time. About 15 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, I was a huge fan. And I'm a rock girl at heart. And back then, a lot of their music was like music to my soul. And it got me through some of the harder times. A lot of my friends were musicians. And I never saw them live, never could afford tickets to their shows, but knew one day that in my heart, and I'm like, there probably will be an opportunity. They were like my top five favorite bands, and he was just already like an artist I've always wanted to work with. And this past summer, while I was designing So You Think You Can Dance, I just happened to turn on their music. Nope, let me rewind. I'm so sorry. So a year ago, I was reading a release that they're coming back together on tour and they're playing LA on my birthday. And I looked at my team and I was like, I'm going to be at that show. We're going to go to the show. We're all going to go together. And I just jokingly said, I'm like, I'll probably dress them. And a lot of things in my career have happened to manifestation. Like, I'm a huge believer in that. And I think my intentions were so clear into the universe and I believed in it so much that that happened a year ago. And then this past summer, I was driving to work, I was listening to their music, and I just happened to text my agent and I'm like, you know, I really want to get back into music. It's what I used to do. I used to do a lot of live performances. I used to do a lot of music videos. I need to feel that again, even though I'm surrounded with music all the time and I'm doing all these shows, but there was a disconnect in my career to where it's like, I love live entertainment. And she was like, who do you want? Like, are we going after pop stars? And I'm like, no, I've done all that. I'm like, I want to go back to my roots. Like, I want like Incubus or My Chemical Romance.
Nice.
Or Red Hot Chili Peppers. I'm like, get me back to rock and roll. And she was like, well, you know, they're touring, but it's probably and I'm like, just let's put it out there. And then within 2 weeks, I get an email from her and be like, hey, their managers want to meet with you. He wants to meet with you. And one of the biggest things about their aesthetic is one of the, like, probably my top three costume designers, Colleen Atwood, like, did their Black Parade album, and it was, like, so incredible. And I, back then, I was always a step behind. It's like they did the Black Parade, and then I met the photographer later. Then I worked on a project with him. So it was always, like, some better late than never, I guess. And I'm like, I'm going to work with him someday. I love her work. Like, I've been told by many people we're a lot alike, you know, and I'm like, why not? And so we get this email that he would like to, you know, take a meeting, see what we can do. And I never expected to do the tour. I just wanted to, like, open this door of opportunity to just collaborate, maybe do one thing together. And he just showed up in my studio, and it was just an amazing artistic, like,
were you starstruck?
Energy.
I mean,
I was trying to hold it together. I mean, before they came in, I can't tell you how much I paced. And usually there's like 15, 20 people at my studio. We're all kind of, and this was like the time, the day that I was alone, you know, and I didn't know what to do. And of course, like, my expectations were just to do, like, present myself and see if I would be, like, a good asset to them, and something that, because I love their music and I love what he's about, and I also, like, it's not just the front man for me. I think he's a brilliant artist. So there's a lot of things that I just wanted, like, our worlds to merge somehow. And within, like, the first 5 minutes of a conversation, I'm like, oh, I get his brain. And I told him my story. I told him that this is, like, 20 years in the making, and, you know, I probably sound like a crazy fan costume designer, but we shared ideas. He kind of walked me through the concepts of things he wants to do on this particular tour, and they haven't started doing the U.S. leg of the tour. I didn't know if they had a designer, and then he did mention Colleen was doing something for him, and I was like, okay, how can this be a triangle? You know, can I come in the picture? And it was just a beautiful collaboration, and it was like a genuine artist-to-artist conversation. Okay, like, let's do something interesting. He walked me through his concepts, his ideas, and I'm like, all right, well, let me come up with some creative, see if we're on the same page. Again, as much as I wanted to be like, hey, we're doing this tomorrow, I also felt like it's important now in my career and possibly in his to make sure the relationship is good, you know, that this is right. The right artistic, like, match to one another, and it worked. And yeah, from there, it was just like amazing fittings, amazing collaboration, and some iconic things viral.
I love hearing this from you, because this is like the joyous experience when, oh my God, I've dreamt of working with somebody, you finally get to do it. But I want to take you back to that, because, so I'm curious, how would that process even begin?
Right.
Like, you're working with somebody that you already know their music, you already know his vibe, and Colleen Atwood, who I've interviewed, by the way, on the show, she's incredible. our interview had to go, she was in the middle of a work day, so it was a short interview. But how does a collaboration like that work with somebody like Jared Way? How do you guys start working together? Right. How is that process?
For us, like, it was just like an initial conversation, you know, and I introduced myself, my work, you know, they already did some background kind of checking up to see where I stand, where my aesthetic was like. And I felt like in a place in my life right now, in my career, I was able to bring something new. And that's where my confidence, I think, came from. And at the same time, I didn't want to change the artist that's in front of me. And I think that's always so important for me when working with music. You're dealing with a fan base and a reputation and aesthetic approach that's far beyond any artistic reach of anybody new coming in.
Right.
So for me, it was, you know, having a conversation, understanding what characters he wanted to bring forward. This was a very playful tour. This wasn't about dressing up the whole band.
Right, okay.
This was about him being in this world of iconic characters, and how can we bring this to life, and what can we do that's still very recognizable to his fans, at the same time a little bit of a shock, you know, value. But at the same time, I wanted him to be him, you know, and he was in this, like, beautiful place in his life and career right now where he felt great and felt confident, and I just wanted to uplift that. And we did our creative decks, went through the conversations, which characters we wanted to go with, you know, these are the shows that he had, I knew which city, you know, we kind of wanted to play off, like, where where was the right time? Halloween was right around the corner. What do we do? So it was like very strategic conversations, but at the same time, so much room to play and be creative. So I just gathered the top 10 characters that we had discussed and kind of started doing my own thing and keeping him and the music in mind. Had an amazing fitting, and I've never worked with an artist that's so clear. It was like not just like directional and very precise and very distinct on his own style, but it was just even clear for me when we were doing fittings. This is somebody that knows his body. This is somebody that knows his aesthetic on stage. This is somebody that knows how they're going to perform. So it just made it so much easier for me to be able to fall into his world and do the fittings to where, like, is this going to come off? Is this piece staying on? Are we going to do options? You know, is the character going to evolve on stage? Is the character going to come down on stage? So all those conversations happen in our fittings. And then I just packed it all up with distinct notes, send them off, and then kept checking in, making sure everything was okay. And yeah.
So would you, when you had a direction for the characters, were you doing sketches first?
No, not at all. This was something that I kind of felt like needed to have the research. It wasn't just about designing something on paper.
Right, okay.
You know, when he mentioned to me I wanted to be a vintage cheerleader, I'm like, okay, what era are we in? 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, 40s. And then he was like, find me something that's within possibly this color scheme.
Okay.
And for me, it was like the image that went viral when he did wear the cheer uniform. It was probably like 10 different vintage stores that we went to. And I'm like, okay, everything's size zero. Or like, what am I going to do? You know, this stuff doesn't exist anymore. If I get it from Etsy, it's not going to come in time. There was like so much. And it happened to be like, as we were leaving one of the stores, I looked on a sale rack and I saw this like damaged, weird, like vintage cheer dress that had no zipper, that had no hem. And I was like, I love this. I love this because I can reconstruct it. I can go and get the fabrics that we need to still keep it original and authentic. And that's how we start working. I build out a dress size, a mannequin his size at my studio, put it on, we reshaped it, took the whole thing apart, reconstructed it to be his measurements, and still kept it authentic. And after he wore it, the pattern, I think, for the actual thing was sold out. Like, wow. His fans loved it so much that we were getting notifications that people actually found the original pattern of this 1940s uniform and were buying it out.
That's crazy. Okay.
Oh, it's amazing. When I think, like, to me, it's like that's when things are just meant to be, you know, when not only did my work translate into something beautiful on stage, but then he becomes this incredible persona on stage that then delivers the character and plays it off. And you know, we did that throughout every single look. Every single look went, like, became a fan favorite or crazy. Yeah.
In terms of time, what was the process when you first got the gig and then to the first show that was performing using your work? What was the time frame?
I think I had about a month to get it all together.
Wow.
So that's not much. At the same time, I had another huge project in the works, so it was going back and forth. But I could not tell you, like, I've had difficult projects in the past, and I've had difficult times with artists or, you know, finding our own language, how to execute some things. This was so easy that time didn't matter to me. It was like such a great collaboration. And so it like flowed, like Bruce Lee would say, like water, you know, it just made sense. And no matter how difficult my other project was or what was going on at the same time, it was like, oh, this is like the universe showing me this is how it's supposed to be. You know, this is what's inspiring me. And at the end of the day, the one thing I told you, I'm like, you made me fall in love with music again. Like, you came into my life as an artist that I've admired and, you know, wanted to work with for almost 20 years. And there was a big part of my beginning that just made me look back at this now and be like, oh, that was that feeling that I had when I was 16, 20, you know.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah. I mean, congratulations on
Thank
that. What an exciting project.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And you did so quickly. Well, that the I guess the flip side then would be what I should be talking to you about now is Disney. It is the live Beauty and the Beast. I mean, there has been this new trend of doing live performances of these various things, which some of them have been I've actually enjoyed.
Right.
But so Beauty and the Beast, I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than that. It's been on live, it's been animated, it's been live action, it's been on Broadway. I mean, there's been so many different iterations of this. How did you get involved in this?
About a year ago, I got a call from Done and Dusted that there was another live in the making. The first one they did was Little Mermaid. I was also supposed to be a designer on that, but due to conflict schedules, couldn't do it. So I told them, like, if the next one comes around, I really would like to get involved. So they called me up and said, there's a possibility of Beauty and the Beast. It's the 30th celebration of the film. We would like to do it in the same kind of spectacle as we did Little Mermaid. It was like half animated, half live. Back then I was excited, but I had so much other stuff in the works that I'm like, okay, let's see if this is something that's gonna happen. And with COVID, you never know anymore if projects get greenlit or not. And then a month later, I got a call that yes, it's been greenlit. Would you be interested to come on board as a costume designer? John Chu is gonna be directing, executive producing. And right away, I'm like, okay, this I've worked with Done and Dusted before, never worked with ABC and Disney, would like to take the shot. And John Chu and I have been trying to collaborate on something, I think, for the past 8 years. So it was like, okay, like this is like a team I would like to be part of, and also a classic I would like to be part of. And right away, my brain's like, oh, okay, so I've done Masked Singer, I've done all these things, I can do this, and we've been on this for about a year now. Like, the creative conversation started in January, and John and I had a lot of backs and forth how we're going to do this, and right away, where my excitement happened that I can do this. Every time, like, I thought I got it right, John's like, nope, this is not how we're going to do this. Let's find the language that speaks to us. Let's really figure out what does this classic mean. We're bringing something forward that's been done, like you said, so many times. I cannot tell you how many beasts I looked at, how many interpretations of Belle are out there, like Lumiere. I cannot. I started, like, really, almost like losing myself in the research. I started doing the international research and like, what can we do that's really different? Like, at the same time, this is an interesting scenario because most of the designers, when you get a project, you're kind of given a clean canvas and you're working together with directors and producers to try to develop characters. But here I have a blueprint. I have something that is so recognizable, so familiar, is so praised and admired and loved and respected. I can mess this up,
Did you have any kind of look? Like, obviously, you can't reinvent the wheel because it is what it is. So you've got Belle and the Beast, but it still has to work in live action. I mean, it's different than animation, so you have to work with a dancer. Were you guys given at least a little bit of leeway within certain parameters in terms of character design?
No, it was actually a completely different experience. That it was a creative freedom. It was everything the opposite of that. It was like, what can we do that's not like the live action? What can we do that's not like the animated? And Broadway has done it all. So what can we do that's a little bit more of a modern take and something that's in the now? And again, for me, it's that challenge because yes, I can go so far left and create such a modern feel to this that it's no longer present or recognizable to the film because we are hitting this back and forth presence. There's a visual live and then we're going back to the film. So after doing so much research, I decided to pull Pantones out of the animated, keep the colorways the same, keep kind of this like period underline the same, because the story takes in 18th century. Like, how do I bring my 1800s into this? And then I started studying the understructures and the corsetry and all the technique of that period and where the bum rolls were used and how the women and men were dressed, down to what shoes are we using. So I kept the period part alive. I kept the traditional authentic part alive, and I brought the Pantones from the animated. Everything else we recreated and try to come up with kind of the fresh, new, modern take of what these characters would look like. And at the same time, there was always a conversation about revealing our characters, revealing our cast, not hiding their faces. So I didn't really have a chance of masks, or it's complete opposite for me what I just did before. And when that happened, I was like, oh, well, then I'm going to be really careful about my fabrications. I'm going to be very careful where the 3D printing comes in, or what elements of L200 would I use, and I'm going to manipulate everything with textile instead. So as you see, like Lumiere, I didn't go into the full candelabra effect. I manipulated my textiles and my fabrics to look like drip wax and a swirl of candles. So
okay.
And you see a lot of that through all the characters. But the one character I try to keep true to its nature was Belle. I thought it was very important to have that princess aspect, that transition of a provincial life towards the end, you know, the fairy tale magic, to stay consistent and to stay very true to the story. So you see, like, I'm using the same color Pantones in her designs, but then the silhouettes and the cuts are very different. And then the one thing that I truly reinvented was the yellow gown.
Okay. Yeah. Now, but you kept it yellow?
Well, here's the tricky part. There's a lot of discrepancy out there. Was it gold? Was it yellow? Okay. So the original, I think, was supposed to be gold. And I've done a lot of research to figure out what was the right color. Back in the day, you never know when things were animated, what was the colors that were used to color it in. But historically, there's a lot of articles on it that the dress was supposed to be gold. With the adaptation of Disney, turned yellow. So I kept it both. I try to bring both elements into it. And at the same time, Gabby, who is my Belle, I never wanted to lose her as an essence of a princess. This was such a new and exciting opportunity for her that why replicate something and keep the classic to classic, and I could give her a breath of fresh air and create something just special for her.
Did you have, like, I would imagine Disney's pretty draconian in keeping the copyright and everything right. straight. Did you have to go to an extra level of approval with higher-ups at Disney with your design work because you're playing with one of the most iconic
IPs out there?
Films?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I got lucky or it was something that was done behind closed doors and I wasn't aware what was getting approved. But many, many renderings were done for this. I mean, when I tell you about 30 different renderings of Belle were created just for the opening scene, and this is all that was filtered through John and the EPs, and right. I'm sure Disney had some inkling in it. I know there were many presentations that were done to Broadway and Disney and ABC as to how we would develop the characters. And every time I was like, this was my favorite, or we would agree on something, I got clearance and approval to go along with the story. And I think because I kept so many elements close to the traditional feel and kind of aesthetic, I got a little bit more room to play right. around with more of like a modern take on details or notions or trims, you know. So
yeah, you didn't come in like somebody like Julie Taymor who did Lion King, right. you know, going, we're gonna reinvent this for the right. state. Yeah, you had to keep tradition. Yeah. I guess the story would have lent itself to that anyway.
Right.
You don't want to take some gigantic leap. And I think you're right. Leap.
With something like this, you can't really reinvent the wheel. I just right. had to find a new, fresh, relatable way to do this so that somebody that's watching it at home, it's not, oh, it was for this demographic, or it was for this age bracket, or it was for this generation. Like, I really wanted to feel that this is something new, and I'm just bringing these characters to life that are here to celebrate the film that we're also watching at the same time. But you do see that transition. I was very careful about that back and forth.
This is kind of a random question, but right. with your Russian background, you talk about Bolshoi and growing right. up. I mean, with places like L'Hermitage, and I don't know, you've probably been there. I've yes. never been there, but was there a Russian influence at all, a little bit in Belle's gown or anything like that?
I'm not sure. If it was, it was probably somewhere so deep down in the back of my brain. I did grow up on Beauty and the Beast, so it was a slightly different story. But I'm very much aware, you know, what I grew up on versus like the French version that I watched. And I
was that like John Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, the black and white one, yes, from the 40s? Yeah,
that one, and there was a colorful one that I think from 2012?
Yes, 2014. Right, yeah.
I kind of got to know all of it. I wanted to see how everybody has their own interpretation. At the same time, I kind of wanted to pull influences from every direction. And for me, like I said, I thrive on textile and choosing the right fabrication and being so precise in my pattern making, that I felt like through those elements, I was able to achieve something that's a little bit more elevated and it's a right. little bit more now. But at the same time, I was pulling back to like the traditional way of doing things, you know? So it's almost like finding that middle ground between bringing something forward that already exists and combining with the past and trying to make something in the present.
Of course. Now, are there any things that people should look for, little things throughout the production that you've hidden in there, or things that only you would know to say, oh, look for this, or...
Oh, I don't when even they're watching. Know. There is such intricacy on every single costume that you're going to see. I hope that we didn't miss a step. I mean, down to every button, anything you can think of, to the bow ties, to studying the way LeFou and Gaston interacted and what colors can I bring forward to really have that relationship go forward. It was really, truly telling a narrative through every piece of clothing that they're wearing. Something special that did happen, Gabby called me one day and wanted to figure out how we can bring a little bit of her heritage into the costume. You know, what can I use, whether it's like Filipina print fabric, or, you know, whether we do it on a lace somewhere or tie in her hair. And I was kind of like sitting on it during our conversation, and I'm like, well, if we're going to do this, let's be bold with it. Let's bring it forward. Let's not hide it. Let's not do something that only you and I will know. So I decided to have a hand painted print of traditional alphabet being printed right on her apron that spells out Belle. And I just felt like if we were going to go forward with representation and making sure that, you know, the message is very clear. That was one take on the costume. That is something that I hope the fans will notice.
That's
very cool. Definitely a way, again, to do something different and a little bit more forward.
Wow. Yeah. That's really neat that you did that. It's cool that she
asked. I just thought it was such a great idea. And, you know, we were thinking like first a conversation was something small. And I'm like, well, if you know, why not really showcase this? And I can figure out a way where it would lend itself to a perfect feature. And it was right on the front of the apron. And I just thought it was like such a great way to tell her story through a little piece of costume.
I love that. Yeah. That's fantastic. Well, listen, before we wrap this up, I'd love to ask, like, a lot of people watch a show and they want to know what advice can you give them?
Right.
And I love your story starting out was like so many people that they don't understand. Well, the question I have for you is, what advice can you give for people that now we've got Instagram and people can show their designs and there's so many ways to get it out there, but it's no substitute for hard work. What advice could you give to people who want to follow in your footsteps, not steal jobs from you?
No, please do. Actually, I need a break. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think for me, and I can only give it advice from like my experience, somehow, no matter how difficult or challenging or great things were, I remained very true to my craft by studying and understanding what was my niche, what was my aesthetic, what was my language, how am I going to communicate my art through not just the work that I'm producing, but the people that I'm working with. I know there's a lot of advice out there to keep working hard and keep paying the dues, but I think for me, truly, it was like finding who I was, finding who I really truly was as a 13-year-old, as a 20-year-old, as a 30-year-old, as a 40-year-old. Like, what is it about my work? What is it about the beginning to now that didn't change for me? You know, and I do think as far as skill set, a lot of that can be taught. A lot of things can be trained. You know, our brain is a sponge. We can memorize how to do things. But I think like once you truly figure out your identity, like your art identity, I do think like there's a legacy to be left behind.
And that's any artist's strength, finding who they are.
Yeah.
That's great advice. Yeah. Can people find you on social media?
Yes. I am on Instagram, Marina Toybina, and barely check my Facebook, but I'm also there, also Marina Toybina. And then on TikTok, we just started a page that's Marina Toybina Projects.
Oh, great. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, Marina Toybina, it's been so nice speaking with you today.
You as well. Thank you so much.
Beauty and the Beast, My Chemical Romance, is that tour over now?
They are done for the U.S. leg of the tour, for the North American tour. So I believe he goes back out next year. So I really hope that we continue to be working together. And then Beauty and the Beast 30th Celebration airs, I believe, this Thursday on ABC and then Disney Plus on Friday.
Oh, that's great. So yes. People will be able to see it forever. Thank you so much for being on the Designing Hollywood podcast.
Thank you.
And a special thanks to our sponsor, Paris Costumes. Paris Costumes has been a part of the history of the European theater, film, and television industry since 1856 and has become 21st century tailors. A special thank you to founder and executive producer, Martika Ibarra, co-founder, costume designer, the legendary Marilyn Vance, and of course, John Campia from The John Campia Show. Our technical producer is Taylor Gonzalez. Thank you to all of our viewers for tuning in, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Tune in to the audio version wherever you listen to podcasts. I am, of course, your host, Robert Meyer Burnett, and you can find me on Instagram at RM Burnett, or find me on Twitter at BurnettRM, or on YouTube at Post Geek Singularity. Thanks very much. Like, subscribe, and give us your comments. What would you like to see on the channel? Right down below. Thanks very much for watching, and we'll see you on the next episode of Designing Hollywood.